Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars about research and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm delighted to have back on the show today Nicholas Adams, architectural historian and Mary Conover Mellon Professor of Art here at Vassar College, who is here to talk with us about the exhibition he conceived and helped to curate, along with Francis Kowski and Amy Picard, on view at the Buffalo and Erie County Library in Buffalo, New York. That exhibition is entitled Building Buffalo, Buildings from Books, Books from Buildings. Hello, Nick.
Thank you, Tom.
So this is an exhibit that's similar to one we talked about on the show a while back, a few years back now, I think it is, that you assembled from my library, the art library here at Vassar, with the help of students in one of your seminars here, which also featured an important and substantial catalog, as this exhibition about Buffalo architecture does. And that was an exhibition about a collection of architecture books within a library also. So first question is, why Buffalo and why its public libraries? Is Buffalo an architecturally interesting city particularly?
Well, the short answer to the last part of your question is yes. Yeah. Buffalo has wonderful architecture. It has a great tradition of inviting important architects to build important buildings. So Louis Sullivan builds the Guarantee Building, one of the early and most important skyscrapers. Richard Upjohn builds St. Paul's Cathedral, an extremely important example of neo-Gothic. Mm-hmm. And Frank Lloyd Wright builds the Martin House, which is extraordinarily interesting, large, and beautifully restored building. Going on from there, Eliel and Ira Saarinen build the Kleinhans Music Hall in 1940. So there's a great long tradition of Buffalo's interest in architecture. And I'd actually say one more thing about that. It's a heritage of architecture which the city of Buffalo is protecting and discovering. So it has been a current interest of the citizens and of the city government to make that heritage available to the public and to protect the heritage that's there. I mean, this includes buildings both later and earlier than the ones I've mentioned, and vast tracts of really high-quality housing. So there's lots of reasons to be interested in Buffalo from the point of view of architecture.
Buffalo's been traumatized in the last 25, 30 years with the loss of the steel industry that supported so much of the economy of that area and subsidiary industry. So I expect it's a fine thing to have something to celebrate about the city. At one time, it was a very important metropolis in this country.
Well, one has to imagine that Buffalo in the 1940s and 50s saw itself surpassing 600,000 in population. Mm-hmm. Certainly, people might have predicted that it would go past a million, becoming thus one of the major North American cities. It's now in the 200,000s, and of course, it's the steel that's gone, but it's also the transshipment. The St. Lawrence Seaway has, of course, made an enormous difference. You don't take the grain off the boats from the Midwest. You just ship it straight out to Montreal, yeah, rather than stopping and transshipping. And of course, the Erie Canal was an important termination point for a significant trade that develops in the middle years of the 19th century. All that's gone. So, I mean, it's one thing to have architecture. It's another thing to value it and to care about it. And that's something the city has really put its mind to. They held, for example, a few years ago, a national conference on preservation that was held in Buffalo. The Society of Architectural Historians met in Buffalo. So there is a developing self-consciousness about the traditions of the city.
Hopefully it will become like Chicago in that, which really has its act together in terms of its self-consciousness about its architectural heritage.
Well, Chicago, of course, is a model for all Midwestern cities in that regard. And Buffalo must look to places like Chicago as a model for how things need to be done. There are other things that need to go into place, of course. I mean, there's a new upstate medical center which has been supported by the state, mm-hmm, and which will provide a major employment center and then will attract to the area, other industries related to medical services, but also related to the development of machinery and tools related to medical service.
So first part of that first question, was it this architecture that sort of drew you there and helped you to come to the idea to do an exhibit?
Well, this is a little bit of a story, Tom. I was in Buffalo in 2014, 2015, actually starting in 2013, looking at musical life in Buffalo and thinking about the way in which music develops in the wake of architecture and the way in which architecture develops in the wake of music. And Buffalo had an extremely important concert hall by Eliel and Eero Saarinen, Kleinhans Music Hall. And I was working, actually comparatively, looking at the city of Gothenburg, which in 1935 also built a significant concert hall by Niels Einar Eriksson. So I was brought to the city by the tradition of its architecture, and I found myself sitting in the library, the public library in Buffalo, in the Grosvenor Room of the public library in Buffalo, and working quite closely with one of the librarians who was there, a woman by the name of Carol Pejacki. And Carol, having heard of my interests and having discussed with me what I was looking for, was that most elegant and most brilliant of librarians. She brought me more things that I could not have known were available based on her knowledge of the collection. So I would be sitting there and Carol would appear out of nowhere and slip a book over to me and say, "You might be interested in this," or a box and say, "I think there's some things in here that could be useful for you." And then she would evanesce off into some other part of the library. And I began to depend on Carol, because sometimes I would say to her, "Well, how do I look this up?" And she would say, "Well, you know, I'm really sorry, it hasn't been cataloged yet, but you should look at it now." So that I found myself, from a scholarly point of view, working in an ideal environment. Here was a librarian who knew the collection, had been there for many years, listening and interpreting what I was searching for in relation to a collection. Mm-hmm. Well, that's irrelevant in some ways to the subject at hand. But I would go home after my times at Buffalo, impressed with both the insight, the enthusiasm, and the intelligence that the library staff showed. And in addition, I would sit near the front desk, and it was a desk that was there. There was no particular reason to sit hidden in the back. Mm-hmm. And I'd also listen to the way in which, in a public library, the librarians have to grapple with everyday problems of a big city library. So I was not the only scholar, but I was certainly the one that occupied a certain amount of time. Maybe there were two or three other people there. Most of the people who came in to the Grosvenor Room, which is the local history and rare book area, were people who were interested in researching their genealogy or researching a song lyric. And sometimes they would stand in front of Carol or the other librarians and sing the song, and they would have to guess what the tune was and what the relationship was, or they would come in speaking only Polish and wanting to research it. I was, in a certain way, deeply impressed, because I've lived my life in an academic institution where there are people like you who are committed to actually the scholarly life and the growth of students. But I was impressed by the way these people all handled the day-to-day operations of a public library. And let's understand, the Buffalo and Erie County Public Library is in downtown Buffalo. Yeah. So you have a downtown traffic, and that means not just people like me or people looking for song tunes, but people who want to sleep and people who look, they really should be under better care. So I would go home at the end of my time, having enjoyed myself. And at night, just to amuse myself, I would start searching in the catalog, online catalog of the Buffalo Library. Well, I'm an architectural historian. So in addition to looking for things related to music and related to Buffalo's architectural development, I started investigating, in a way, the same kinds of things that I investigated when you and I were involved in putting together the exhibition that was held here at Vassar. And I began realizing, as I put in search terms, whether it was the word architecture or architect, And then I would limit it by date to see what works were published in that period, that the library had somehow, without telling me, without telling anybody, had amassed an extremely large collection of books on architecture, uh-huh. starting with works from the late 15th century, printed in Cunabala from the 15th century, and right up through really the beginnings of modernism. I mean, it's fair to say that their modern collection is not as rich as the early collection, including editions of Palladio, Serlio, Schinkel, Viollet-le-Duc, Olmsted, Downing, you name it, so that one could put together a list of about 400 works mm-hmm. that covered that period. Some first editions, some bound in the classic atom bomb resistant bindings that, librarians sometimes put on their books. Yeah. But they had been put together. And I, on the basis of that, in January 2015, I wrote to Carol and said, have you ever thought of putting on a exhibit here? And Carol passed my letter on up the chain at the library, and it went to the head of the rare book area, a woman by the name of Amy Picard, who became a collaborator and a friend, and Meg Sheeman, who was her superior, who also gave invaluable advice and lent a hand, and then ultimately up to the library administration, and they thought this was a great idea. Yeah. And so we started to work.
So you had a library within a library, essentially, there in a way.
Yes. Yes, and you had a library within a library created, it should be said, Buffalo is in a strange situation, perhaps not so strange, but at least unfamiliar to me, in that it actually had two public libraries mm-hmm. in its history, going back to the 19th century. One, the Grosvenor Library, which is now part of the public library system, and it's called the Grosvenor Room. Yeah. And the other, the public library. And the public library was a lending library, and the Grosvenor was a research library. So what we were looking at was, in effect, the bringing together in a single collection, which was done when the libraries merged in 1953, uh-huh. of two collections created under slightly different conditions.
Two institutions with two different missions originally, but interestingly, those missions were able to merge.
Yes, I think it was probably I don't know the history of the merger, but I'm sure it was a thought to be economically. Yeah, sure. There were also things that had come out in the kind of contradictions between them. And oddly, interestingly, architecture was at the heart of it. Uh-huh. Because both libraries collected architecture. The Grosvenor regarded this as material that needed to be preserved for research. Mm-hmm. So, for example, designers would be able to go back and consult the early works of architecture and design for ideas, or engineers to know the practices that had been going on. And the public library was collecting what it saw as contemporary books. Uh-huh. And both of them, in effect, competing for an architectural market and a clientele. And in fact, this comes to a head at a certain point in the 1930s when the Grosvenor, the research library, wants to claim architecture for itself. And the public library wants to claim architecture as its subject. And the public library makes special facilities available for architects where they can smoke. Where they can consult the works without their coats on in private rooms.
So there's actually a space in the library for art.
Yes, there was a space there. And the Grosvenor takes exception to this, not because of those particular facilities that are available, but they observe that the public library is not following the rules because it is not loaning out its architectural books. And it says, it claims back, no, we are the ones who should do it. In fact, in the end, prior to the merger, the Grosvenor is determined to be the site for architectural books. But the fact that there's this competition suggests also that the competition ran through the collecting practices, mm-hmm. each in a sense trying to gain the interests of a certain clientele as a way of justifying their positions. The old problem, as we know, of how many people are coming in the door and why this is not something which is new, but goes back.
Interestingly, I've worked in libraries a long time, and I've developed a kind of maxim on my own. I haven't heard anyone else express it, but it's always seemed to me with collection building that collections build their communities in the way that communities build their collections. The two are intertwined. They're both, there's a back and forth. It happens in academic libraries, certainly. A place like Vassar, we teach certain subjects, there are certain needs. We try to appeal to those needs. But on the other hand, if we get a special collection in a certain area, we can influence the curriculum. And it seems to me that's happened here, too.
Yes, I think so. Well, there's the famous story of the music department at Harvard complaining about the librarian buying folk music and books about folk music. And they went to complain to him, saying they weren't interested in that. And his answer was, you will be. And they were.
So do these libraries, either of them or both of them, develop an architectural population in Buffalo? Or certainly they're serving a population, they believe they're serving a population of architects in a city that's growing in huge ways.
Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah. The city's growing. Buffalo does not have an architecture school until after the Second World War. Uh-huh. It has something else, however, and I think this is important and significant. It actually has two other things. One, it has a very busy, rich, active industrial life. Mm-hmm. And industries need to build, mm-hmm. and they need to put buildings up. And so in these years, there are, of course, hundreds, if not more, draftsmen mm-hmm. who are working in architectural offices or for industrial firms. Bethlehem Steel must mm-hmm. have had its own architectural design office. Yeah. So you have a population of people, many of whom have not been to architecture school as such, but have studied drafting either through high school or in the mechanical mm-hmm. courses in the technical high school.
And the steel plants, both of them, Republic and Bethlehem, were like cities. I mean,
yes,
they had
absolutely.
Their own railroads. I think
absolutely.
Both of them
Yes.
A tremendous amount of building.
And in response, there are a few architects who have studied at architecture school. I mean, a few. There are a handful, if not more, architects in town who have studied at architectural schools. One, indeed, quite prominent, George Carey, who had studied at the École des Beaux-Arts and comes back to Buffalo, opens his office, employs architects there. The office of E.B. Green as well, studied abroad and collected around him a group of architects. But look, architectural work, if you're a draftsman, is absolutely mind-numbing mm-hmm. and dull. And so the city also developed a club for the instruction in architecture. This was tied to the School of Fine Arts, École des Beaux-Arts in New York, mm-hmm. and the architects who had been educated at the École ran this school. It was called the Atelier Rectagon, mm-hmm. Which was a reference to the Octagon House in Washington. Mm-hmm. And they brought in draftsmen and others and gave them an education in architecture based on the principles of the École des Beaux-Arts. And those people also formed one of the sources for interest mm-hmm. in architectural books. And in fact, we don't need to speculate about this, because the Rochester architect, Claude Bragdon, who works for a while in Buffalo for E.B. Green, in one of his autobiographies, one of his accounts of his own life, refers to his experience of going at night mm-hmm. to the Buffalo Public Libraries and using books. Uh-huh. So what would you do? You were given a problem. You needed to go find its historical precedents. So these books actually served the architects who were in training within the city at the Atelier Rectagon. And I'd say one more thing about that. And in a way, this gets to the heart both of libraries and of this form of civic culture. We know about the gentlemen of breeding and good taste who went to the American Academy in Rome, and we're familiar with those kinds of people. Those were generally upper class or wealthy middle class students who could get the money to go to Europe.
Yeah. I'm thinking Henry James.
Think Henry James, right. Louis Sullivan managed it, and Richardson, and these were people of ability and of means. The library is the great democratic institution, and the Atelier Rectagon is the chance for the population at large, architectural population, but also city population, to take advantage of its great democratic institution, the library, mm-hmm. to study the great monuments of culture, the great works of culture, and bring them back to Buffalo, the western frontier, far away from the centers of culture.
Yeah, well, at one time it was the western frontier.
That's right. Yeah, that's right, absolutely.
It still has that identity in a sense. It is called Buffalo for a reason.
It is called Buffalo for a reason, yes.
Can you talk more about the importance of books for the history and practice of architecture, sort of generally speaking? I mean, books are important to architects, full stop, aren't they?
Well, certainly historically, it is the book that travels, the building doesn't.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So at a very simple level,
you can't study architecture without going somewhere to look at it. Or
you either, and here on the frontier, here in the New World, books are absolutely critical for the development of architecture. You need to know what the great works of Italy looked like, the great works of Rome. These are the cultural ideals in time and place. And so books become the means of transmission. They become it at a second moment as well, as architects in the second and third decade of the 19th century begin to make pattern books. And the pattern books show typical or ideal forms of detailing for classical buildings that workmen, contractors, can build up in Massachusetts and western New York and then in Ohio and then in Illinois. And as those books circulate, buildings are built from them. So books become the source of architecture, and they're the means of transmission of architecture. So at some level, particularly in places that are not London or not Paris or not Rome, the book is the critical medium of transfer. So books build buildings. But it's also true that buildings build books, so that when people visit Rome, they want to draw or they want to make representations. Or if you're an architect, you want your buildings to be represented in books. So you create these great elephantine books. Garnier does it, Schinkel does it, Fischer von Erlach does it. They create books that then carry their message forward and show their great skill as builders to posterity. That became the undertitle for the exhibition. It's an exhibit about the building of Buffalo, and it is extremely important that the books that were collected were the books, in effect, that became the basis for the building of Buffalo. But the second title is Buildings from Books and Books from Buildings. So it documents also the way in which you shift between the built work and the image to the building.
Your project here at Vassar, I remember, was something of an archaeological project, in that you were mining, essentially, the collection for architecture books and making discoveries as though you were going down through layers of time. And did you do this again then in Buffalo? How did you go about your research? I mean, did you have access to accession records?
No, this was one of the frustrations and stimulations for the project. The accession records were insufficiently organized from the point of view of research. That is to say, you could get the accession books, you could turn the pages, but we're talking volumes of books, and when books came in was not always clear, and the record was broken in some places. So, for example, we never tracked down all the books that George Carey left to the library, which numbered in the thousands. We actually couldn't even find where they were recorded. So that was a bit of a problem. So the research actually began with something very simple, which is the internet catalog, which of course is available to anybody. It requires no particular brilliance to work through an internet catalog. We then moved from there into the bulletins of the libraries, which talked to some extent about the ways in which books were brought in. There was some correspondence. We did do some shelf wandering. I imposed myself on Amy Picard on a couple of occasions and said, I just want to walk the shelves and see what I can find in the appropriate section. And that did produce some things that I might not have found through the card catalog, or might not have noted through the card catalog. But no, it was largely out of something as dumb as the internet and the internet catalog.
With the books themselves, pouring through, did you find things out about the books as objects themselves, as kind of artifacts? I mean, about the books' histories or book plates?
Vassar's collection has some very clear roots.
Yeah.
And the collection in Buffalo does not have the same kind of clear genealogy to it. These were a group of librarians who, and I think this is the thing in a way that is both frustrating but also meaningful. These books were collected over time, roughly 60, 70 year period from the last decades of the 19th century into the 1930s. They were carried on, this purchasing, by generations of librarians. Mm-hmm. August Shearer was probably the best known in the Grosvenor Library, but he wasn't the first, and he wasn't the only one. The collecting of architecture was, in effect, a kind of collective endeavor on the part of the library to meet the needs of the growing city. Mm-hmm. So there were collections that came in, for example, a collection of the landscape architect William Harding that comes into the library, and the Carey collection comes into the library. E.B. Green gives a number of books to the library. So these are 19th century architects or 20th century architects who are giving books, but it doesn't have the same kind of genealogy that you see in a private library, yeah, which is what Vassar is, yeah, where distinguished alumni, I mean, in the case of Vassar, for example, Phyllis Lambert, yeah, gives an important book. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That doesn't happen. There is something which happens which is just as interesting, however, and that is the sense of it being a collectivity is, I think, one of the most interesting observations. I mean, there's no great collector of architectural books in Buffalo. It was the effort of group of librarians and a group of citizens to create their library. That is, they were building, as they were building the city, they were also building the library. So, for example, one of the things I noted as I looked through the lists of books, I kept saying to myself and kept saying to the librarians, why do you not have any Piranesi here? I can't believe you don't have Piranesi. And I would repeat this every time I went up or in emails. And we found that there was indeed in the catalog reference to 29 volumes of the collected works of Piranesi, put together in 1835, mm-hmm, in Paris.
Famous collection.
Famous, which we don't have at Vassar. Yeah. We have earlier books, but we don't have that one.
A little bit too expensive.
But it was there, but it didn't have a call number. Mm-hmm. Oh. So we had one of those final denouements when I said, look, it has to be there. And one of the librarians said, well, I think I know where it might have gone. And we went down together to the stacks. He said, I think it was filed with periodicals. Uh-huh. Because 29 volumes, uh-huh, a cataloger looks at 29 volumes of Piranesi in a foreign language, mm-hmm, says, no, I'm not going to catalog each one. But if I treat them as a periodical, I can just have volume 1 through 29, yes, and okay, that's it. And indeed, that was the case. Uh-huh. Now, the situation with the Piranesi was fascinating because we then discovered that it was sold to the library by a visiting dealer, mm-hmm, from Cleveland, a man by the name of J.H. Jansen. He's quite well-known book dealer. He'd come to town from Cleveland. He'd offered this to the library. And we found letters in which the library wrote saying, we don't have the money that you want for this book. It was $1,200 and they couldn't afford it. This is 1925, so prior to the Depression, but still, they didn't have the money. And so they went around to the architects in town to make a collection. Mm-hmm. And so it really is the book that's brought by the community to the library because the architects recognized that they needed that work. Uh-huh. So it's a wonderful vindication of the sense that there on the frontiers you needed the image of Rome, mm-hmm, as created by Piranesi that could inspire you.
So with the architecture building books, is there an attempt to collect works on local architects like Sullivan and Wright?
Some. I would say it was not uppermost. It does have the early books that are published in Buffalo. Lewis Allen, for example, after whom the district of Allentown is named, uh-huh, in Buffalo, has books there. There are the requisite works by Sullivan, mm-hmm, some by Upjohn. Wright is well represented. Mm-hmm. But it's not, they have a much broader mandate.
Yeah. So the libraries themselves, are they monumental, the Grosvenor and the...
They were. No longer. It's a nice building from the 60s.
Yeah. They knocked the old building down.
They knocked the old buildings down.
Yeah, like the Larkin building then.
Yes, we will not go into that.
It's like the Penn Station of Buffalo. Yes,
that's right. Well, yeah. Yes, there is the Penn Station of Buffalo, which is another problem. But I think that's why the protection of the heritage and the recognition that this is part of the heritage is so important.
So preservation, I mean, apart from these collections being important for the building of Buffalo, they have become important for the preservation of those buildings. Yes, yes.
They should be. And I think that it's something the city has slowly recognized. I mean, you could put this in like even in a larger context. And in that sense, what I think I'm most proud of the exhibit and of having done the exhibit with, by the way, the most ideal of collaborators in my colleague Frank Kowski, was that we're doing public history. That is to say, we are trying to contribute to the city's understanding of itself. If we go back in Buffalo's history, it was conceived in the 19th and early 20th century that Buffalo needed certain things to be a great city. It needed a great city hall, and it got one.
Yeah, it did it ever.
It needed a art museum, and it has a very fine one in the Albright Knox. It needed a science museum, and Chauncey Hamlin founded the science museum in Humboldt Park. It needed great newspapers, and it had them in the Buffalo News and the Courier Express. It needed great libraries, and it had that in the Grosvenor and the Public Library. It needed a freestanding concert hall, and it got that in the Kleinhans and in the orchestra, the Buffalo Philharmonic, that is a significant American orchestra. And it needed great architecture. And what we're trying to incorporate into this image of the city is the books that were bought as part of this process of making a great metropolis. So the exhibit, in that sense, has a very important, to me, and I think to Frank, and to the library, a very important civic role in advancing these books as part of the cultural crown that Buffalo wishes to claim.
So a lot of the classics of architecture, you know, Vitruvius, Palladio, look to Rome as a model for a city. And Buffalo struck me for the time I was living there, reminded me of Detroit in terms of its old plan of it, and that it's a planned city, and it's planned on Rome, essentially. I mean, it's a hub-and-spoke city plan with wonderful parks, Delaware Park, these great landscape gardens that you could go to. So the older city certainly was planned. I don't know, when you got down to the steel plants, I don't know if you felt that way quite, but...
No, it has a grand plan, part of its early formation, and the Olmsted Parks are an essential part of that.
So was Delaware Park an Olmsted project?
Yeah. And I think the Piranesian scale manifests itself in Buffalo's City Hall by John Wade. So if you walk down from Lafayette Square, you've got what? An obelisk and a column. An obelisk and a column on the way. You've got these great boulevards that extend out. And if you want to carry that image forward slightly, the greatest Buffalo architect of the 20th century, born and raised in Buffalo, was Gordon Bunshaft. Born in 1909, educated in the public schools, Lafayette High School, then goes on to build for Skidmore, Owings & Merrill in New York. But you almost feel that for Bunshaft, the monumental buildings of Buffalo's past were ingrained in him, those great wide open streets. He was just around the corner where he grew up from the hospital of H.H. Richardson, which virtually loomed over his house. So big architecture was in his blood.
Is that right up the block from the obelisk and the City Hall, the Richardson Hall?
No, it's a little bit farther out.
Okay, there was a big Richardson building there.
Yes, it's now been restored. It's a psychiatric hospital.
Thinking about preservation, I was really impressed a while back, and I know you've been to Philadelphia lately. I don't know if you frequent the Athenaeum at all, but they make a really kind of heroic attempt to collect plans of buildings, Philadelphia buildings, going back as far as they can, but also contemporary structures. And I'm wondering, is this collecting ongoing?
I mean, Buffalo needs to think about that.
There are architectural firms based in Buffalo that are doing lots of work.
I think the new architectural center, which is going to be headquartered at the Richardson Building, will have something of that role. But of course, as you know, maintaining architectural records is costly.
Yeah, it takes expertise and it's
difficult. Expertise and space.
Yeah. And in the digital age, it's very difficult because it's another set of problems. You're not just working with drawings anymore. Yeah, sure. So let's talk about the catalog then. You've got this wonderful catalog. It's about 80 pages, wonderfully illustrated. And you had collaborators on the catalog and the project, yes?
Yes. In a way, with respect to them, we should start with collaborators.
Yeah.
I was the one that started the process of hunting out these books, but I was very aware that I needed local help.
Mm-hmm.
And I've met some wonderful people in Buffalo. Buffalonians are rightly proud of their friendly and mm-hmm. helpful nature.
Real people.
Yes.
I always thought to myself, if I ever was walking down, you know, Delaware Avenue and Popeye and Bluto came walking down the street, I wouldn't blink twice. They would fit right in, you know. So
yes. The other thing that one notices in Buffalo is that in comparison with downstate is that you'll be walking down the streets and people say hello to you.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Or good morning. Uh-huh. Yep. And I would no more think of doing that in my own neighborhood than, it's not something that happens typically in downstate New York.
Yeah, yeah.
So the two people that were closely involved in this, and the third as well, the first was another architectural historian by the name of Frank Kowski.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Kowski has taught his entire life in Buffalo. He is the person in Buffalo, in the architectural community, who knows the architectural history. He's mm-hmm. written preservation reports. He's written important books on Olmsted, a very important book that grew out of his own dissertation on Frederick Withers, who built, incidentally, the Poughkeepsie Mental Hospital and was an important mid-19th century architect. And Frank has been involved in every phase of the study of architectural history. So at some point in early 2015, I contacted him. We had met before and had a perfectly good collaboration on an architectural prize for the Society of Architectural Historians. And I invited him to dinner in a local restaurant of his choosing. And I said, Frank, I need help. I need somebody who is going to examine Buffalo, the books that are in the library, in relationship to the buildings that are there. And we, in a sense, divided up the tasks at that point. The second person who was absolutely critical for this was the rare book librarian, special collections librarian, Amy Picard,
mm-hmm.
who facilitated our passage through the mm-hmm. vaults and into the archives mm-hmm. and into all the things that the library offered. And she had an intern there who was a recent graduate in museum studies by the name of Nicole Conziella. And Nikki was sort of the person who accompanied us through many of these.
So Virgil to your...
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, well, I think Amy would probably qualify for the Virgil, but this was at least Virgil's amanuensis.
Uh-huh.
But the four of us just worked extremely well together, and we divided up the catalog into three parts. Frank wrote a wonderful essay in which he really showed in some very specific ways how Buffalo's architecture depends upon historical sources.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's an essay for local people living in Buffalo. But on the other hand, it's a kind of model for how you read the buildings of a city as the results of historical processes and historical traditions.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Reading Buildings in Buffalo. And he literally walks you through the city. It's wonderfully illustrated through a generosity of the person who helped and the institution that helped underwrite the catalog. And so that's one. The second essay tells about the assembly of these collections. So that is written by me with Frank and Amy, called Battling for Architecture, about the building of the collections.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells a bit about what we know about how the collections came together. And then I've written a piece, just simply in general, using the books in the library, written a history of architectural texts and their relation to building, just in general, starting from the beginning, called Buildings from Books and mm-hmm. Books from Buildings.
Was there a Vassar connection here?
Well, there's a tangential connection to Vassar. It's all well and good to have a good idea. And we believed that the idea of getting these books out was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly had support from the library. But as all librarians know, funding isn't guaranteed for special projects.
Yeah.
And I had the good fortune to meet a woman who is the executive director of the Baird Foundation, a woman by the name of Catherine Schweitzer. Mm-hmm. And Catherine simply backed us through the Baird Foundation, which is a community foundation which helps foster community development, the development of community activities, and also with her own interest and support for architecture. She had her mother, Bonnie, is a Vassar graduate, and her son, Gray Schweitzer, is a Vassar graduate too. And Gray very kindly made donation to help the catalog and the exhibit come to a reality. It should be said that the notion of putting out a catalog with a designer, a superb designer in Howard Gralla, who's designed some Vassar catalogs as well for the Loeb Center here.
Yeah, it's really nicely done, beautifully illustrated, nice tones on all the black. Yeah.
Well, this was something that the library hadn't done in decades. So it was really a first for them. And it required all kinds of things, like changing the directions that the doors open into the area where the books are kept and new cases. And and here the Baird Foundation and Catherine Schweitzer could not have been more generous and more supportive. This was the chance to get the books out. It's a chance to make some noise about the books. And we were very fortunate to have those supporters, as well as the support from the library itself, which really gave wherever it could to make this possible.
Yeah. Beautiful photography. I mean, nice cameos of so many interesting...
Yes, Frank really challenged himself. I think there are something like 70 illustrations for his text in an 80-page book, and Howard had to fit them together. This was no small undertaking.
Interesting. I never thought of the Skyway in terms of the city of tomorrow. He mentions, he makes that connection. I have to say, it was something to drive on. If you'd never done it, you missed something. It was like being on a roller coaster. Really. Yeah. You didn't want to get a flat tire on it.
No. Nope.
But it was something.
No, you can get something of the experience, I think, on the Kosciuszko Skyway out of Newark and into New York City. But this is special. Yeah.
You had to be especially careful around the steel plants because the smokestacks would throw smoke over the skyway as you're driving through and you couldn't see, you know.
A small detail.
Small detail, yes. So how long is the exhibition up and where can people get a catalog?
Well, the exhibition is up for a year, so it's up until March of 2018.
Uh-huh, quite a long time.
It's on for a long time. Yeah. The catalog is available online through the Buffalo and Erie County Public Library, so you can click through and you'll find the catalog available there.
I'll put a link to the Library Cafe website. Yeah. So I'd like to thank you, Nick, for visiting with us again on the Library Cafe, this time to talk about your exhibition, Building Buffalo, Buildings from Books, Books from Buildings, Books on Architecture and Landscape from the Rare Book Collection of the Buffalo and Erie County Public Library.
Thank you, Tom, also, and thank you not just for the interview, so beautifully conducted, but also for all your programs through the year. And I'm honored to be the last of your interviewees this year, but you make a real contribution.
Oh, well, thanks. Let's see here.